It's Sunday, July 21st, 2024, and you're listening to episode 625 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 43 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Mary.
This is Doug.
And this is Wayne.
All right, so Wayne, you were putting forth a question that at first I was prepared to dismiss as well.
Like most people do of everything I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, it was coming out of a ginger mouth, so I'm like, whatever. It's not even necessary. I'm just going to recast Wayne on the next episode anyway.
Eminently replaceable.
Yeah, eminently he's getting recast. But nonetheless, I found it interesting the more I thought about it, because I realized the question you asked was not the one I was answering mentally. So why don't you go ahead and state the question you were actually asking?
Okay.
And then I'll state what it isn't.
All right. So this was inspired by the fact that I just kicked off a new campaign.
So your games are inspirational.
Of course.
All right. Outstanding.
The question is, what is your goal of session one?
Yeah.
Now, I'm very specifically not saying session zero.
And that's what threw me, is the first place my brain went is session one. I had mentally categorized as just the natural outcropping, like leaves on a tree, of session zero. So there's no question to be answered here. If you've answered the session zero question and your session zero was successful, all session one tells you is that session zero is bearing fruit. It doesn't tell you anything about itself. And as I contemplated that, I realized that was a rather limited way of thinking about things.
Yeah, it's specifically the very first session of roleplay. I have different goals, whether I'm a player or a GM.
Well, where do you want to start this?
GM.
All right. So what are your expectations for session one as a GM, Wayne Go?
All right. So as a GM, my goals for me, I need to get at least three NPCs in front of them and see how they react to those.
So Wayne wants three NPCs, okay.
I need to see how the characters are talking to each other. I am looking for how lethal and vicious are these characters, because people will talk about it in session zero, but you don't really know who the characters are until they start getting played.
Yeah.
And that's really my first set of goals, is discovering who are the characters that are actually going to be talking together. Even though these other two have ties in their backstory, the players are not the two that are going to talk.
So let's start with one of those sub-points that is so overly broad that I feel like it needs to be discussed, but I don't want it to become the show's focus because of the fact that it's so overly broad, which is, who are these characters really?
Yeah.
Because in session zero, if you've done it right, you said we're supposed to be playing a game of people that are merchanting wine along the Mississippi and Missouri rivers, but in reality, we're a bunch of ne'er-do-wells and hired guns who are going to get in shootouts over water from the Merrimack Springs. And so you find out that the characters that were planned in session zero, the characters that were created on paper, oftentimes do not correspond to who they're actually playing as individuals or who they're playing as a group.
Yeah, you might not be able to get that out of session one. Sometimes it takes two or three sessions to really gel who they're going to be, but you can start telling
in session one. I think session one you get it.
Especially in role-playing terms, like somebody will take a while to find a character's voice, but the things they're going to do tend to be clear from the start.
Yeah, session zero's intent, session one, is the first step of actual action. It's the first step of actually saying, apart from who I intended this character to be, here's who I'm actually going to play this character to be. And I'm with you, Wayne, in that you don't often get that in session zero.
No, it almost never makes it from concept to table unaltered.
Yeah. As a player, I never play the character that I made in session zero. Yeah. I play the character that comes out in the table because of the people I'm playing with.
Yeah, because, you know, sometimes you don't even have the ability to play the character you wanted. It's not even per se that the player wrote down, I want to play character A, and then just for no reason shifted to character B. but rather the events of the plot or the behavior of the rest of the party forces them into a character B. That, for example, they intended to play the person who was going to negotiate out every conflict, but the entire party sans them is going straight to violence.
Or the GM doesn't even present them with anybody to negotiate with.
Yeah, so. Everything's just monsters.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything's Umber Hulks, and there are no townspeople you can negotiate with. And so to participate in this game, you have to play a complete psychopath.
Yeah, I've also seen where somebody created a character. Let's say they want to do the talkie character, and they fail every talking role that first session. At that point, they've set in motion, in reality, this character is not the talkie character. Even though all of their stats say they're the talkie character, I have failed 5 roles. The team now doesn't trust me to talk.
Say the character is going to keep trying and going to probably keep failing. Whether or not the dice come up failures, nobody's going to let them have the last word.
Let me ask a really hard question here, because of the fact that I want to defang this topic a bit. But I'm going to do it by moving the fangs elsewhere. So it's like zero-sum fangs. The fangs I'm going to remove from the topic is that the person didn't play the character they said they were going to play. Now, that may be true in the most academic sense, but let's be honest for a moment. How many of us, if we were to roll the tape back however many years, are the people today that we expected ourselves to be or desired ourselves to be 10, 20, 30 years ago?
Not even close.
Yeah, exactly. Not even close. But have you sold yourself out? I don't think it's the same thing. It's who you were met the conflict, the tension, the pressures of reality, and had to adapt. And that changed who you became versus who you intended to be. So if I was to take the real Wayne, Doug, Mary, Dan, whomever, and say, well, this is who I intended to be when I was 15, versus this is who I turned out to be when I was 25, 35, 45, then you start to see a very different person, not because you sold yourself out, but because the realities of life aren't what you thought they would be, and that forced you to be somebody else.
I'll take another analogy, though, of actors. So let's say a play, the exact same role by 2 different actors can come off very differently, even though it's the same lines, because while something's written on paper, that can be interpreted different. I can see the character that you made on paper, see what it is, and in my mind, that means one thing that could be completely different in your mind.
So
as a GM, I need to see what you really meant by what you put on the sheet.
So right off the bat, I can think of 2 characters that have both been played by about 50,000 people that the geeks listening to this show should have an opinion on. Pick your poison between Batman and Spider-Man. Who is the best Batman? Or Bruce Wayne, if you want to make that bifurcation.
Or
Spider-Man? Or Joker.
Spider-Man Joker. / Peter Parker.
How about
Joker?
James Bond.
I was thinking that.
James Bond. Damn it, Doug, you took it out of geekdom and into the mainstream, so I'm going to give you an
answer. Hang on. You don't think James Bond is geeky at all?
No, I think he got picked up by geeks, but I think he was originally a Cold War dime store drama sort of thing. I think he was supposed to be mainstream and ended up nerdy. I don't know. But anyway. All right, fine. I'll give Doug a D+ for today. Okay. He's at least passing.
Yes.
I have a weird
who's your favorite Batman? Who's your favorite Joker? Who's your favorite Spider-Man? Who's your favorite James Bond? And there's a list of people to pick from that have attributes that you don't have to go for some banal social thing to pick between. There's nuance in how they present that character, but all of them effectively started from the same source material. Ian Fleming novels, the writings of Bob Kane, the writings of Peter Parker was Stan Lee. I thought that was one of his. He didn't steal that from someone.
Jack Kirby.
Yeah, that's not another Kirby lift, is it?
Mm-hmm. To a degree.
Yeah, okay. I mean. Yeah.
So this was either Stan Lee or Dave Arneson, one of the two. And we're just going to pretend we don't know
that's
which.
Okay. None of them are alive anymore. We're fine.
Yeah, we don't know. So, all right. But yeah, I think that right there is a great one. Is the players may have set out in session zero with a social pact that they fully intended to align to, that they fully intended to be what they said they were going to be, to behave along the parameters they said they were going to behave along. But upon contact with the other players, the particular plot you've picked out, quite frankly, I don't mean to victim blame, but I'm going to go ahead and victim blame. Sometimes it's the GM's fault. The GM presented one game and then in session one reveals a world that is a bit different than the one that the players thought they were going to encounter.
Or even drastically different. It's come down to, oh, everything we talked about, that happened over here. Throw that away. We're doing this.
I'm trying to blindside you because that's how I get off on GMing.
Yeah.
And that's not my thing, but have I played under that GM? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where you thought you were playing a Victorian romance, but this is actually sci-fi, Lovecraftian horror, and you just don't know it yet. Well, I'm sorry, but that's not the same character anymore.
No, your tea drinking skills have a much different meaning in this precisely. Game than you expected.
Who this man used to swoon for versus who he now draws on, that's two very different questions, and you didn't ask me the second.
Yeah.
So that's one of my big things for session one is, so, who are they really?
So I want to talk about three NPCs.
Yep.
What do you mean? I mean, I get the idea that you throw some NPCs at them to see how the party reacts to different kinds of people and outside pressures. But that is such a specific number. Where did you come up with three NPCs?
So part of it is, like you said, you're throwing out things to see what they latch onto.
Okay.
But a big part of it for me of introducing NPCs is world building. We've agreed to certain things about the world to begin with, but the NPCs are my vessel for world building. So if I give you only one or two, you're getting one or two perspectives. I want at least three perspectives on the world that are different to see what do people gravitate towards.
Do you intentionally design your three NPCs to sit in three different social archetypes?
Yes.
If here's the peacemaker, here's the compromiser, here's the lunatic.
Not necessarily like that, but it may be something like, okay, there are three major factions in this world. I want at least one NPC of each of those factions to be introduced to them.
Okay. Or
basically, they just have to have a different perspective. They need to not be the same type of character.
So this is effectively like putting three radically different dishes out at a buffet to see what people latch on to.
Exactly.
And
but also giving flavor of the world by showing there are people that have these different views in that world.
So you are testing the setting vis-a-vis the NPCs.
Exactly.
You're using the NPCs as a very thin facade for the setting. Have you ever had it, though, where your player said, I didn't like the NPC or did like the NPC, but I had the opposite reaction to the setting they represented? I just liked something or disliked something about this NPC that the faction as a whole doesn't either attract or bother me with?
I don't think I've ever had a player give me that useful of information ever.
Okay. I have. It's usually in much less useful, bitchy, and off-kilter format, but I have received that value or received that message.
Yeah. I have just in watched, a less Yeah, I have watched way. My players get interested in a group but hate an NPC.
Yeah.
And then I will make other NPCs come to the forefront for them to deal with. Or I will continue to give them the one they hate because they like to hate him.
Yeah. You know what? The character you love to hate,
it's still engagement. You want that engagement.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. If people tune in because they're hoping to see so-and-so finally get their ass kicked, that's still
tuning in. Yeah.
Yeah, there's been some debates I've seen online, and I don't think this is so much the case with us because we don't really thrive on controversy, but a lot of people that cannot distinguish their follows from their hate follows, you know, that works in RPGs as well, that if people keep tuning in because they want to beat so-and-so's ass or want to be there when he gets his or her ass beat or whatever, that's still workable material. Yeah.
No, I would love to have a player actually give me useful feedback. I've had very little useful feedback ever.
Okay.
Bits here and there.
I have gotten
But never that. Something so direct and actionable.
I have gotten that feedback. Now, not always in a terribly pleasant, thoughtful way, but it was in the end actionable. I guess I'll accept that. It's sort of like being thrown in jail for a crime you didn't commit. I mean, it's at least actionable, even if it's total BS.
But yeah, you know, I like the market of NPCs, throwing out ideas, seeing what they grab onto. If I'm lucky, one of those NPCs will become their new favorite character that will stay throughout the entire campaign. But I'll be honest, most of the NPCs I throw out in the first session don't make it through the campaign. It's ones, session two or three, they'll find somebody they really like.
Well, and how much of that is sort of the same problem that the players have in finding the voice for something? How often do you get it exactly right on the first try in session one?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I have an NPC in mind for my current campaign that I really like what I've got planned for him. And so I didn't introduce him in session one. I want to give them two or three sessions before I bring him in, because I'm not ready to present him, and I don't think they're ready as characters.
You know, there may be some value in that. Of, I don't know, I want to make this its own topic, but don't give them the most valuable stuff up front. Don't throw your pearls before swine.
Right. You don't want to make it a throwaway session, but you maybe want to hold back some until you get a better handle on what's happening.
I'll be honest, from a session length standpoint, I tend to not run a long session for session one. It tends to be shorter to break the ice. And if I give them any sort of action, I give them a softball.
Yeah.
Yeah, Wayne, let me ask you about that. And I've got a couple other things I want to ask you about before I jump down to my thoughts on this, which is, you just talked right there about session length.
Yep.
Do you think there's a value into making it, I don't want to say a total throwaway session, but a rather limited session in terms of content and length, simply because you're still learning things about the players are still learning things about the world. It gives you a chance to readjust if this does not go even vaguely how you thought it would.
I definitely think there is, especially if it's a new system to anyone at the table. Because if you're learning a new system while you're learning new characters, you may find out that something you took on the sheet makes no sense.
Right.
Just may take you longer to play through the same thing because you keep having to find out how you do it in the system.
Yeah, and as a GM, I have my cheat sheet of whatever I'm playing. These are the rules I think are going to come into play. And invariably, there'll be something that happens that I didn't think of, and I need to hit the PDF so I can search for it really quickly.
So there was something else you talked about that I think is great to talk about here, because session zero doesn't deal with it because it's very hard to predict, which is character to character interaction.
Yeah.
And I mean, player character to player character, not player character to NPC or NPC to NPC, because the game master has typically less investment in their NPC and usually is more willing to move an NPC off or change who an NPC is versus a player who has an investment in only one character tends to be a little bit more fixed on who they are and therefore does not respond as well when character to character, whether that's PC to PC or PC to NPC, does not go how you expected. Because that's not something really in too firm a form anyone's committing to in session zero.
Yeah, I've seen so many times a campaign start and characters that were written down to be best friends end up barely interacting throughout the campaign and they gel with other player characters.
I have run more than one game where six sessions in, I'm like, do you guys remember your siblings? And they don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or you were supposed to have saved each other's life and they don't remember that. And I have to pull out their entirely too long or entirely too short background and be like, by the way, you guys are supposed to be best friends. Is none of that here? Are we just not doing that?
Yeah. Sometimes you can call it. You may have two people at your table that you know their character is going to be best friends, even if their backstory is written that they drastically hate each other because the two people like interacting with each other.
Yeah,
that's but you can't always do that.
And you can't do that at all if you have a group of people you haven't gamed with often. And again, not everybody is going to fall back into the same character relationships, even if you have the same players.
Yeah. There are some people at my table that I don't want to sit next to each other. Because they will be talking.
You to name someone and, I already know the answer, so go on.
Yeah, they will be talking and side role playing and distracting everyone at the table.
And even if it's game related, it's still distracting everyone at the table.
I remember Chad and Brandon that totally didn't do this to my Skies of Glass game. They were great players, they were great contributors to the game. Wayne, there's one more point I want to pull out of what you just said. Before I start getting into my thoughts on this, most groups in any RPG tend to have, usually in the form of an unelected, unplanned leader. Just what I'm going to call a social leader, someone who just has a strong personality presence, that the group ends up tending to fall into one, maybe two or three different camps of how to approach a problem. And is that approach guns out first? Is that approach let's talk and bring them over to our side? Is that approach to lie to and hoodwink them? But there's usually one or two people where everyone else is a bit more uncertain of their character or has a little bit weaker of a presence. I don't want to say personality, but a presence at the table. And so tend to just play follow the leader. Well, because this person shot, then asked questions, or because this person asked a lot of questions before they shot, then I'm going to look for the things on my character sheet that supplement that play style, and I'm going to just fall in and be like that.
What can get interesting is when you have that, and then you have one of those players miss a session, how the entire party reacts differently with that player gone.
Oh, there's a show topic. Have you ever had one player miss one game and it's changed your entire campaign? Different subject, but interesting question.
Yeah.
Usually you have a player so you know which player is going to be the leader. But I can look back on multiple campaigns and the player that you would think is going to be the leader frequently is not the one that ends up leading from a in-character standpoint.
Yeah, or doesn't lead the way you expected. Let's go back to the Blades in the Dark actual play we did. Look at the degree to which Proust was a leader from behind. Look at the degree to which he drove party action, despite the fact that the entire party either despised him or was so creeped out by him they would have nothing to do with him.
Yeah, that was a case of, on paper, Eric was our leader.
Yeah.
But he never really led in character.
Yeah.
He was very much a let everybody lead themselves.
Whereas Proust at least had a direction. Everyone found that direction horrifying, and rightfully so. He was not a good guy. But nonetheless, he had a direction and had a plan. And people tended to sort of coalesce, not in the middle of that, because no one in their right mind would want to be in the middle of what he was doing, but to coalesce in the eddy currents. That the way he was moving sort of broke that tension to let them through.
Well, and it's a case, too, of when you have a character like that who always has this strong force of directionality to them, even if other characters have different directions and different things, in moments where they don't have an immediate goal, they're more willing to just follow along behind the one character who always has that drive.
Yeah, and I said, you may on paper have somebody listed that is going to be the leader, that it just, that doesn't work out in play. Things happen differently. You know, maybe that player isn't comfortable being the leader. The Skies of Glass campaign, Brodor was our leader, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, he was supposed to be.
But he was never leading.
No.
I got a question for you, Wayne. When you're doing this first session, if someone claims to be the leader, do you ever give them the nudge to do more as that role, or
no,
you just
because
let it happen.
If they're not going to step up and be the leader, I'm perfectly fine letting one of the other characters step into that role that's more comfortable.
Yeah, leave
and
it.
Just say that the person that is leader on paper isn't actually the leader at the table.
Okay, this is definitely a distinction between us, probably because I tend to run a lot more organizational or military type games.
Very much so. If I were running Star Trek and the captain was like that, I would say something.
There's a problem. Yep. If the first officer is running the crew or the second officer is running the crew, now there's a couple ways to play that. You have a dysfunctional ship, or that captain's about to get demoted or transferred out to a cargo scow.
Yeah, but because I avoid organizations, nobody has a title that's going to put them in charge in one of my games, typically.
Because nothing says they have to be the leader.
Exactly.
It's just a question of, do they claim to be the leader? And that's a very different in Miscreants than it is, say, a starship or a military unit or something like that, where the person with the highest rank really needs to be doing something.
Right.
So let me throw in my thoughts here. First of them is, I think the nice thing about session one is people tend to be less attached to it than any session thereafter. That session zero, people set out their plans, and if upon first contact with reality, which would be session one, that doesn't happen, people tend to be a lot more willing to say, okay, that didn't work. You need to reroll your character. You need to, if you want to play this, that's fine. You need to create that, and we need to rethink the group template. Let's do a bit of an iteration here. So to me, session one is kind of a gateway. That if I don't feel comfortable with session one, it's my first test of whether session zero was accurate. And so if we can't bridge session zero to session one in a meaningful way, unless everyone is just having a phenomenal time, I'm not going to attempt to move from session one to session two. I know right here we have screwed up. We need to iterate back to session zero and say, is this really what you guys want to play? And if so, that's not the group you made. If that is the group you want to play, then you guys need to give me some different information here.
Have you noticed, because you mentioned that players are less invested in them, so willing to make changes. Have you seen that as a detriment? Because one of the things I've seen is that players on session one are less bought into the game because you haven't given them anything yet other than session zero.
Oh, to care about?
Yeah, so I find one of the reasons I try to make session one not as long is I have a harder time corralling my players and keeping them focused because I haven't given them things yet. And so they are less serious about the campaign.
I think, if nothing else, it at least gives me some meaningful questions to ask. Because I can go beyond the, well, in theory, in session zero, you said this, but in session one, something opposite to that happened. Because then they can throw it away as, well, I didn't expect this kind of moment to come up, or I didn't think the game was going to be like that. Whereas now I can move past that to say, so-and-so, you told me your character was supposed to be a highly peaceable dealmaker. Why were you the first person to blow this guy's head off? And even if they can't explain it away, they can at least give me a meaningful explanation of, well, because you approached me like this, or because my character has these boundaries, or, whoopsie, I played my character wrong. I shouldn't have done that. You're right. Can we mulligan that? And so I at least have actionable information, even if it's not the information I wanted. It's at least something I can work with. So I think another thing that I can ask here that goes fully the other direction from GM to player is, so what did you think? Now that you've actually had a chance to play your characters in context of the game I intended to run, did you like it? Did you like your character? Did you like the story? Did you like the setting? Did you like my NPCs? Is this still what you guys want to be as a group? If not, here's a relatively low commitment handy place to change that out. And Wayne, like you, for this reason alone, my session one doesn't tend to be highly committal. I don't start the major plot in session one. I'm usually just laying out a buffet of ideas to see how they're going to interact with them and what they're going to latch on to. And this is stuff that might be relevant to session one. I don't want to be a true mulligan, a true throwaway, because then the players don't feel like they have to show me the real characters. But I like there to be some flexibility toward the game they're seeing if they say, no, this is not working for me, it is not campaign destroying to rewrite the game from there.
You really hit on the important part, though, with your questions. My problem is that I don't come up with those very pointed questions. Like, your questions were all things that you would ask right after session one. They are perfect. I would instead say, so, any feedback?
Right.
And I'm going to get nothing.
You'll get nothing off.
You're going to like, no, it's great. Yeah, we.
But if I would have thought to couch it in terms of, okay, we wrapped up session one. You've seen the world. You've seen how it's different than other GMs may have run this world for you. What do you think of? And give them a couple of examples. I would be more likely to get actual feedback.
I think there's value to asking, did you like the meal? Because people may give you feedback you didn't expect. But I think there is also value to saying, was there too much cinnamon on the carrots? Because this asks a very specific question that gives people something very specific to begin with. And oftentimes, at least in my experience, the players branch away from that. No, the cinnamon on the carrots was great. But now that you mention it, they were a bit overly sweet. Okay, so now it wasn't the feedback you were asking for, but you got something.
Well, and the players get something out of it, too, in that if you ask specific questions, they can know what were the things that you were focused on in a way that they might not have picked up during the actual game, which can be helpful as a player to know, okay, well, you really planned out this, but we went over here and did this, so can you make this more interesting so we engage with it more? Or are you willing to throw that away because we really like this thing over here?
Yeah, I got no feedback on it, but all of this is reminding me of one of the things that happened as I threw my three NPCs out. One of them, one of the players, was so vindictive against that character that while they are, and mind you, I built this as a character that they would hate.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I hit the right triggers. Because while everyone is trying to steal things from opening night of this theater, that player is trying to ruin that character's date.
Penny, I like it.
And everyone supported the ruining of the date because I had set up enough reasons to dislike this NPC.
Once again, petty, but I like it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then that took one person away from actually helping them reach what they were trying to do.
I think the first character I encountered in any fiction that felt like that to me, I think it was a character named T.R. Hughes in the Sentinel subseries of Robotech, which is the only one that was written from scratch because the rest of them were based on the contributing animes. It, by the way, if you've never read the 18 book, I think they've added some books since then, but the first 18 book series of Robotech written by Jack McKinney, great books. But there are five of them, which are the Sentinel series, which is my understanding are the only ones not taken wholesale from the plot of an anime. So Jack McKinney, which was actually two people, were writing it from scratch. And the main villain in that, or two main villains arguably, the Invid Regent and then T.R. Hughes, who is a human traitor. I have never had a book or series of books that was so page-turny simply because I could not wait to get to the part where this guy died. Because I hated this guy so freaking much. For anyone who doesn't want to run torture scenes in their RPG, don't run that character for me. Because it would get graphic. It would get something wicked.
And not because of anything that character would do.
Nope. It'd be purely me. I totally understand I would be ejected from the group after this, but I'm still sailing that ship. So, Wayne, there's something else that I like to do, which I want to hit on here, which is what are my story elements actually in practice? Because you talked about this from the player character standpoint, but I have the same issue from a game mastering standpoint that in many cases, I'm moderately good at least at reading my table. And so there are things I'm adjusting about who my NPCs are. What does the big bad really want? How is the plot going to present itself? What kind of jobs are going to be offered? What are the individual sub-games or subplots going to be about that I am adjusting on the fly once I see how my players actually interact with the world? If I go back to the real early parts of the Skies of Glass game, there was that scene where some people on a little island out in the middle of the river were trying to intimidate the guy that was kind of the aristocratic mover and shaker of your hometown into giving them a better deal. And they were pretending to threaten to kill his daughter by, quote unquote, dousing her in gasoline. But the area's primary export was actually fruit juice. And they had just found a light brown colored fruit juice that was apple juice they were dousing her in. But from a distance, it looked like they were pouring gasoline all over. And if the party had reacted in terms of trying to understand what was going on, learn the truth of what was going on, and de-escalate the situation, there was one ending. Whereas if the party was like, well, screw it, we're just going to attack the people on the island because we hate them for messing with the kid, or, you know what, this guy's wealthy and the whole town's turned against him, let's rob him. I mean, these are all very different games. Right. And at that point in time, these were all very plausible outcomes within the group template to what I was going to get. And so seeing precisely how your party opted to handle that was going to shape much of how my game was going to run. And so in many ways, just as you have your three NPCs, I try to run the entire game that way, of being a Rorschach test. Of here's this kind of vague and highly interpretable situation. How are you guys going to interpret this and then react to that? Because what you've presented to me in session zero, you know, may not be what you actually play, but I need to also know it's not what you actually may play. And therefore, I need to adjust my game accordingly.
Yeah, if I remember that correctly, we went the de-escalation talk down route with that.
And you found out it was actually not gasoline, it was apple juice, and they were just posturing. They had no intention of immolating this little girl. They were just posturing because they were desperate. And ultimately, she ended up feeling equally upset by both the townspeople and her own adoptive grandfather or father, whatever he was, that she joined your crew and became its really unofficial leader.
Yep. So depending on the system, one other thing I do differently as a GM, I'll ask for more roles in session one than I will in future ones. If it's a system I've run a lot and the players have all played a lot, I don't do that.
Is that just to teach mechanics?
Yes.
Okay.
When it doesn't matter.
Well, gotcha. And
specifically, if I can get a mini combat in session one,
Find out your character's useless before you have to find out your character's useless.
Exactly. Yep. That.
Yeah.
Give them roles when it doesn't matter so you can let them see how roles work so they'll know how to do when it does matter.
Well, yeah. And give them a chance to be like, oh, I didn't realize you added that to that. I should have put more points in this to be effective at what I was trying to be effective at.
I actually, like, one of the very first things I do in a session one is combat encounter. Right off the bat, because it brings the characters together and they find out what their characters can do.
You know, I actually almost started this campaign in the middle of action with kind of that in mind. And I was talking over with some people and I got the advice of not do that. Give them some RP first. I kind of wish I would have gone with that.
Totally.
I like in media res because it gets people directly into the character right away. In mechanical standpoint, and then they come into it with RP.
I think you have to strike a balance there, though, because if it is just a roll dice, kill things encounter, mm-hmm. you're not learning much about your character except whether or not it's effective at combat. And there has to be some nuance to the situation where you actually have to deal with a situation or deal with an element of the situation that is more than just kill it.
I think everyone at the table is right, because I agree with Doug in that it makes a moment in the game where the players have to come together, because if someone's shooting at you, you're all on the same side, at least for that moment. And that oftentimes can lead to more productive role play than if you say you're in a bar where you guys can all hate each other and that's fine. That's just how it is. I think Wayne's on to something in that it tests your character, puts your actual mechanical character through the paces of, holy crap, I did not realize that my character actually plays like this. I didn't realize this one die was going to be so important to how I'm trying to portray this character. I need to move that up.
Yeah, and it would be the easiest fight they have in the entire campaign.
Yeah, and I'm going to agree with Mary that you can't leave the combat as a standalone thing and only do that because it zeroes in your problem solving and reaction spectrum or boundaries to be so narrow that you don't really learn about the characters. So I absolutely agree with Wayne and Doug in that I think the combat should be there. But I think, like Mary, I would keep it somewhat minimal because I need to understand who these characters are when they're not being shot at, when they're not being forced to agree with each other, or at least to work together to survive.
Well, let me go back just a hair here. I set up a short little narrative, and then I'm like, roll for initiative. Like, for example, you've been told to guard the bridge by so-and-so, and it's just normally a BS little job, but not today, and then right into combat.
What I thought about doing, but I didn't send the message out because I knew my players didn't want homework this time, was I thought about starting it off in the middle of a job gone wrong and send each of them an individual message that said, when we start the session, this job has gone wrong and it's all your fault. Why is it your fault? But send that message to every one of the players. So each character thinks that it's their fault that everything went wrong.
Oh, because you didn't specify you in the plural versus you in the singular.
Yeah, send it to each person individually.
Yeah.
So each one has a reason why they think it's their fault.
Yeah.
It may not have been any of the characters' faults, but each character thinks it's their fault.
That is something English lacks, is a plural second person.
Yeah.
You serves as both the singular second person. You, Wayne, caused this. Versus the plural of you, Wayne, Doug, and Mary caused this.
I think we've adopted y'all for that.
I think y'all, like some other words, should be just adopted into the mainstream English language because I think it serves a purpose. No other word does. Unlike literally, which literally does not need to be its own antonym. The fact that literally is literally its own word and literally its own antonym blows my mind and ruins my faith in the human race because a word should not be its own antonym.
I feel the same way about the word condone, but, you know.
Yes.
Or wait, is it sanction?
I don't know.
It's sanction because sanction can mean both we are okay with this and we are not okay with
this. I feel like I am a dying breed because I am the last person who is simultaneously a grammar pedant, yet I am also standing guard at the door of irregardless. As a portmanteau, not a double conjugation, people look it up. It is a real word. Mm-hmm. But now that I've thrown that out there, which is going to get people talking, thank you guys for tuning in. Have a great week and great games, and we will catch you next time.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2024. Listeners are free to use this episode in a non-commercial endeavor, so long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. If you wish to support this show and its related endeavors, you can do so at patreon.com/feartheboot.